as a spokesperson, your credibility is pretty much, I mean, your credibility and your access, right? If they know that you have access to the director or the people who have the information and they believe that you're not going to lie to them, that's the whole ballgame, right? I think one of the challenging things over the past few years, particularly just watching how this has played out, reporters in the national security or foreign policy space are tending to trust anonymous sources more and more and trust spokespeople less and less. And I think that's really dangerous because in general, at least the spokespeople I worked with, I can't speak for the current administration, but we were the ones who I did not want a reporter to print something inaccurate. I would not let them if I could help it, even if it would have helped the agency. Right. So I think that if you can establish that level of credibility, that's the way it's supposed to work. It becomes really dangerous when reporters start saying, I don't trust the spokespeople. I trust this one anonymous source who may or may not have an axe to grind. That's when things get really dangerous and why the credibility piece is so important.
I'm David Preece, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, February 19th, 2019. The Central Intelligence Agency, by its very nature, is a secretive organization. Yet, it has a robust public affairs and media relations operation. How does the agency resolve this tension? How do its employees, from the director of the CIA, through its director of public affairs and spokesperson, to the officers needed to assist in this effort, deal with the difficult questions of how open to be? To find out, I sat down with Bill Harlow and Marie Harf, two former CIA officers who were in the middle of it all. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 393. Marie Harf and Bill Harlow on CIA Public Relations. With me today are Bill Harlow and Marie Harf. Bill Harlow was the director of CIA's Office of Public Affairs from 1997 to 2004. Since then, he's been an author both on his own and with former CIA officials, such as George Tenet for his bestseller, At the Center of the Storm. Bill also started a media training and crisis communications firm called 15 Seconds with former NBC correspondent Fred Francis. Bill coordinates book reviews for the Cipher Brief and serves as a member of the board of the CIA Officers Memorial Foundation, whose unique mission is to assist the families of deceased CIA personnel. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Good to be with you.
Marie Harf, who after serving at CIA as a Middle East leadership analyst, was a CIA media spokesperson from 2008 to 2011. After that, she left the agency to work on President Obama's 2012 re-election campaign and then to serve at the State Department as senior advisor to the Secretary for Strategic Communications and as the department's deputy spokesperson. She's now a Fox News TV analyst, co-host of Fox News Radio's weekday evening show, Benson and Harf, and teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. Marie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Bill, let's start with you. When you arrived in 1997, it was a different agency in many ways with a different public position than exists now. If you could describe the status of media relations at CIA then and how it changed with September 11th and its aftermath.
Well, when I got to the agency, I came from a military background where the military is fairly forward-leaning dealing with the news media. And we tried to establish that same approach at the agency. I would say that the difference was that there wasn't a tremendous amount of media interest in what we were doing. There were some throughout the period, but the pressure was not as great. We were still talking about the things that we were thought were important, including the threat of terrorism, but the reception, you know, was not as intense. Post 9/11, you can imagine that we were on speed dial from every news organization on the planet, calling in looking for information that suddenly was much more relevant to them.
And just because of all that demand, did you find you had to change staffing levels?
We didn't really because there was such a demand within the agency for staffing on other things. We had two speechwriters, and we probably went down to one speechwriter at the time because we weren't giving too many speeches, or the director wasn't. Mm-hmm. And we put that person on to dealing with media stuff. We just worked longer and harder and more intensely than we did at the start.
Mm-hmm. Marie, your formative years at the agency came in that post 9/11 period, and then you entered CIA's public affairs, inheriting what Bill just described. After a career up to that point, running and hiding from the press, why did you shift to media relations, and how did you find the environment there?
Well, I think that for me, when I saw the opening come up at the agency for the job, it appealed to me because I wanted more of a 30,000 foot view of the agency and how we did business. Being an analyst is you're very focused, sort of tunnel vision on what you're covering. I covered the Saudi royal family. So I was very much interested in what the agency was doing, both sort of holistically, but also it is part of the whole conversation in Washington politically. It was a really interesting time at the agency where we were coming out of a period where there had been a lot of disclosures about detention interrogation, a lot of press scrutiny, and General Hayden, who was the director at the time, and then Leon Panetta, who I also worked for, both, I think, wanted to be as forward-leaning, as transparent as they could to try and rebuild what some people thought was a lack of faith in the CIA. So it was an exciting time to be there because you could represent an agency more and more publicly and get the agency's point of view out, because it was, in so many respects, often presented as a caricature by people who didn't know anyone working there. And I think that combined with this was really the time of the rise of social media. So it became, I think, very true and is even more true today that we needed a forward-looking, proactive press strategy, not just with speeches and reporters, but also online, because so many people were out there writing about the agency in the aftermath of Iraq and RDI heading out of this period, that I think it was important to have people in that office who could look at this new media landscape and think, okay, how can we play in that space?
So did you think of it more as a reactive process on the social media front? That is, things are coming at us from that new direction, we need to respond? Or were there some ideas circulating there about we need to be active in this space?
Yeah, I think it's both reactive and proactive. And it's not just social media like Twitter. I mean, Twitter came later for the agency after I left. But it was more just the pace of news got so much faster that when even a newspaper would come to you and say, I have these four classified things I've been told, you didn't have a week to run them down because they would post the story that night. Mm-hmm. So it was the combination of social media, this period in the agency coming out of what some people thought was a dark period publicly for the agency, and we tried to push back on some of that, but using all these new tools to get the message out. And I think General Hayden and Director Panetta were both really invested in that process, both proactively and reactively.
Sure. Bill, that issue of pace, you started in 1997. Certainly, there were a lot of things going on. Pace probably didn't feel slow. Mm-hmm. But by the time you left in 2004, after September 11th, things heating up in Iraq in a big way, did you notice that difference in the pace of what the media expected from public relations?
Sure. I think it continues to this day. It keeps getting faster and faster. The amount of outlets there are, the number of places that are looking for immediate input. So that's just been moving exponentially in one direction, and it increases the burden on you because, as Marie said, you don't have a lot of time to respond to these things. And if you don't respond, your absence of a response will be taken as confirmation sometimes. So there's a lot of pressure in order to get out there quickly when you have something that you can say to help put things in perspective.
Now, that's different than the perspective of the CIA a lot of people had. And maybe this was more true in the 1950s and 1960s of deny everything, no comment on everything. All that a person doing media at CIA ever has to say is no comment. That wasn't even true by 1997, but it certainly wasn't true by the time you left.
No. That is a common misperception, is that all you do there is say no comment. It sounds like a pretty easy job, chief spokesman for a secret organization. You know, when I got to the press office, they had some souvenir coffee mugs that had the word no comment with a circle around it with the international no symbol. And I sort of banned those because I thought it sent the wrong impression to our own staff that we were there to say no comment. My view was that we should comment when we can, say what we can, so that in those cases where we have to say that we're not able to respond to your question, that we have some credibility. If you say no comment to everything, then you have no credibility when you tell somebody, no, you really shouldn't report that because you put lives at risk or something. So you needed to do that only when it was necessary.
Sure. Marie?
And the challenge that I'm sure Bill also came up against is a lot of the workforce. So in order for us to get answers to these questions, we needed to know the truth, even if we weren't going to tell reporters. And a lot of the workforce is resistant to telling press officers what the actual truth is about secret things because they think we're just going to leak or tell reporters as if we can't control ourselves. So I think that we probably both went through a process where you work with the building both to get them to trust you, to tell you what actually is going on so you can craft a response, but also to get them to understand the time crunch. I mean, that's part of it. The building does often not move very quickly. I think it's getting better, and I think there are good reasons for that. But to convince, you know, the head of the Directorate of Operations or whatever it's called now, I really need to know what happened here. And if you're not willing to talk to me about this, they're going to post a story tonight that may put your asset, your operations at risk, or they may just be wrong. That is a constant process inside the agency. I think people are realizing more now that we cannot, nor should we, just say no comment or close our eyes and cover our ears and pretend like the outside world doesn't exist. We can actually do good for the agency by engaging. But that internal process is as hard as anything about doing that media job.
Let's get into the nuts and bolts of how you do that, how it is that you manage that commentary on things that generally you can't give details about. And we could do that by debunking some myths or potential myths. You can be the ones to tell us about the CIA and the media. I'll ask both of you to react to each one of these. First to you, Bill. Myth number one. CIA spokespeople simply lie to the press about everything. True or false?
Totally false. I don't know of any spokespeople who have lied intentionally. I've said things to the press which turned out to be wrong, but that was because I, you know, didn't have the right information. If you lie to the press and the press find out that you lied to it, you have no credibility. They won't come back to you, or they will report that you've been lying to them. And so it makes no sense for either, you know, moral reasons or tactical reasons to do so. So, you know, you try to answer the question to the best of your ability without damaging sources and methods, without putting sources and methods at risk. And when you can't answer, you do. And when you don't know, you say you don't know. There's lots of ways to not answer a question without either lying or putting sources and methods at risk.
Marie, tell us, did you just lie to reporters every day about everything?
No, I agree with Bill on this. And I think as a spokesperson, your credibility is pretty much, I mean, your credibility and your access, right? If they know that you have access to the director or the people who have the information and they believe that you're not going to lie to them, that's the whole ballgame, right? I think one of the challenging things over the past few years, particularly just watching how this has played out, reporters in the national security or foreign policy space are tending to trust anonymous sources more and more and trust spokespeople less and less. And I think that's really dangerous because in general, at least the spokespeople I worked with, I can't speak for the current administration, but we were the ones who I did not want a reporter to print something inaccurate. I would not let them if I could help it, even if it would have helped the agency. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that if you can establish that level of credibility, that's the way it's supposed to work. It becomes really dangerous when reporters start saying, I don't trust the spokespeople. I trust this one anonymous source who may or may not have an axe to grind. That's when things get really dangerous and why the credibility piece is so important.
One way of getting that credibility, of course, is to actually give favored reporters the crown jewels. So let's turn to myth number two, that CIA spokespeople often give highly classified information on background to their favorite reporters to arm them to get the message out that the agency wants out. Bill?
That would also be not true. And for a variety of reasons. One, just the wrong thing to do. But two, agency spokespeople are all subject to the same background investigations. We all, you know, get strapped up to polygraphs. And if you were handing out classified information to reporters, that would become clear when your reinvestigation came due, and you know, you'd be out of a clearance and out of a job. So that just, it doesn't work that way. Now, that having been said, there are reporters who demonstrate that they have an interest and an understanding in the subject, and you may help them with unclassified information because they have demonstrated to you that they will actually write a fair and balanced story, that they won't waste the time of people who you set them up for interviews with, that they'll actually produce something. So it is true that people who demonstrate an expertise in the subject will probably get more help from an agency, whether it's the agency, CIA, Pentagon, State Department, whatever, than those reporters who only parachute in once in a while when there's a crisis going on. But as far as giving them classified information, that's wouldn't make any sense.
Marie, your take?
The challenge is always when a reporter comes to you and already has classified information, mm-hmm. right? So you have to be, because as Bill said, we all get reinvestigated. You go back through the whole process. And when you're asked, have you ever discussed classified information with a reporter, you often have to say yes, because a reporter comes to you and says, I have this classified document. So that's always the challenge, how you deal with that. And it's very tricky and it's very sensitive. And I think it is disturbing the more and more people inside the government, wherever they may be, that choose to give classified information like that to reporters, because then we're stuck trying to clean it up. That's always the really tricky tricky piece of it.
And we'll turn later to the difference between authorized disclosures and unauthorized disclosures in that vein. Let's turn this around. Let's move backward in time with each answer. So we'll start with you, Marie, with your more recent experience. How about this one? CIA's relationships with the media are always adversarial. Is that true?
I don't think so. It certainly wasn't when I was there. I do think that journalists who cover any executive agency, whether it's the CIA or the White House or the State Department, believe their job is to be a check on the truth and to shine light and transparency onto organizations that often don't want that light shined on them. So I think there's an inevitable, not tension, but sometimes tension. I don't think that's too strong of a word. But it reporting at its best, and so journalism at its best and media relations at its best, are not adversarial, right? And I was never angry with a reporter for writing a story I knew to be true that I didn't like, unless it put people at risk, but that I just didn't like. Like, that's not my job to not like stories if they were just doing their job. It was the reporters who were irresponsible with sources and methods, with lives of assets or operations officers, or who just really got their own narrative in their head and wouldn't take the truth for an answer, that's when it gets adversarial. I think when they're just willing to do their jobs, that's better. But as Bill mentioned earlier, there are so many more types of journalists. It's no longer the major papers, the networks, a couple radio folks, the wires. Now there are all these different outlets, and you have to decide who is a journalist that you want to engage with. That's not a straightforward answer. Mm-hmm. That makes it harder.
Bill, how would you describe your relationship overall with the media across the time? Was it always adversarial, or was there that kind of relationship building as well?
No, it certainly wasn't always adversarial. There were a few reporters who seemed to have a chip on their shoulder, and that probably brought out one on mine. but for the vast majority of them, it was professional. You know, we weren't buddies, but you know, we were people who dealt with each other on a professional basis. It was better those who were steeped in the subject, those who covered intelligence for a long period of time, who had already done the background work and knew what they were talking about. It was more dangerous when you dealt with somebody for the first time, totally out of the blue, who came to it subject knowing, you know, most of what they know about intelligence from watching movies or TV shows. But even so, you know, you just dealt with them as professionally as you could and hope that they would return the favor.
Let's talk about that from a different angle, the movies and TV shows, because it's one thing dealing with a reporter who has been on the intel beat for years, understands the nuances there. It's a different thing when you have a Hollywood producer or director who wants to make a great movie that has to do with CIA, but they know nothing about how the agency actually works. During your 7 years doing public affairs, you made a lot of initiative there in terms of working with Hollywood. Talk a little bit about that effort and what the CIA did and did not do with Hollywood to make TVs and movies maybe more realistic.
We did spend a lot of time on that. And the reason, thinking behind that is as much time, I probably spent 95% of my time on media things, news media. But more Americans learn what they think they know about the CIA from Jason Bourne and Tom Clancy movies and things like that than they do from reading the New York Times. So there is a danger that all they learn, if the movies are all totally negative and they show the agency, you know, Jason Bourne, you know, being an assassin who runs around and the agency, you know, trying to kill their own people and all kinds of things, which, you know, are ridiculous. If that's all that's out there, it can have a serious impact on the public perception, which has an impact on recruitment, which has an impact on support in Congress and things like that. So with a little bit of effort, basically one person on my staff who would deal with Hollywood, we would take receptive people and just talk to them and explain to them, no, that's not how it works. No, you don't call a person who works at the CIA a CIA agent. You call them a CIA officer. No, it wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't be walking around the hallways using our cell phones because that's not authorized. We didn't have as much to offer. Coming from a Pentagon background, it was very common for us to work with Hollywood. You want to make a movie, make Top Gun, and you want F-14s. We're the only ones that have it in the Navy. You know, so if you want to work on it, yeah, you know, we have to make sure that the movie is something that we can accept. CIA, is you don't have quite the same leverage. You know, anybody can replicate the seal in the lobby and can pretend to be a CIA officer. But just by offering them some advice and some of the better filmmakers want to make a film which is accurate and reflects the real world, then you have some opportunity to have some impact.
Mm-hmm. Marie, you had an interesting intersection when you were there. You were not handling Hollywood liaison directly, but Bill's era, this was James Bond, Robert Ludlum novels, Tom Clancy, some of those, Jason Bourne by then. By the time you were there, the environment was doing things like Alias, and you had that intersection of that with the social media and reporters coming in with less experience in the industry and more just from an entertainment point of view. Did you find that affected the media landscape when you were there?
I don't think it affected the media landscape necessarily, but in terms of the recruiting point that Bill brought up, I mean, if you think I joined the agency at the beginning of 2006, by then we'd hired about almost half our workforce since 9/11. We were just on a recruiting bonanza, right? Actually, Alias, they filmed a recruiting ad for us, for the agency. The stars of it did.
Jennifer Garner,
right. Yeah.
And we worked with Alias during my tenure there.
That's right.
It paid off.
It paid off. So it was a time when we were recruiting not just the caricature of the CIA officer that was, you know, a white guy from Yale. It was, we need people who speak Urdu and Arabic and Farsi. And so it was the recruiting effort, I think, that's a lot of what drove the Hollywood outreach we did. We also had a number of TV shows with women. So if you think about Homeland, which isn't always a great portrayal of the agency, but...
Or of women.
Or of a lot of things, we should say. But things like Homeland, Covert Affairs, another show on USA, which I actually really liked. I don't think it's still on. But so there were different kinds of agency officers that Hollywood was trying to portray. And sometimes, oftentimes, we didn't think that was a bad thing to help play a role in. What does the 2006 or 8 or 12 CIA officer look like? It's different than the old Ludlum novels, for example.
Right. So, Bill, I know that the pre-publication review process isn't a part of public affairs as such, but it certainly intersects with what you do. This is the process by which agency officers and even former officers have to send in things they are writing that relate to intelligence to make sure they're not putting something classified in there, perhaps inadvertently. There's this idea that process is a political one, a vindictive one designed to keep negative views of the agency from getting out there. How did you interact with that process while you were doing public affairs?
My involvement wasn't great while I was doing public affairs. I've had a lot more contact with it afterwards, and so I've been doing a lot of writing. But my experience with them is that it is not designed at all to prevent something negative being said about the agency. You can say anything negative you want. You can make up stuff, and you can say that we've, you know, kept the bodies of aliens in the basement, and they'll let you say that. They just won't let you say things which are true and are classified, or which could be believed to be true and gained through classified methods. So if you say things which would cause people to believe that you're revealing something secret, they try to take it out. One of the problems now is that more and more people, and this is both a problem and an advantage, more and more agency alumni are writing things. And so the publication review people are inundated with material. I understand that if you submit a novel today, you'll get a form letter back from them saying, we'll get back to you in about a year. That's kind of a disincentive, you know, to former novelist like myself to actually do that because you don't want to wait that long to find out.
But that certainly implies that writing something as fiction isn't necessarily different than nonfiction because they're still checking for classified
information. Even in fiction, if you could give away sources and methods about how you do things, which they would find objectionable. And because there's so much coming in, they farm out their information to the appropriate parts within the agency. So if it's a matter of about Middle Eastern leadership issues, if there might be a possibility of giving away a secret, it might go to the branch that handles that. It could be counterterrorism. It could be whatever. And those people have day jobs, so it takes a long time to get material cleared. And that can be frustrating for authors, but it's not a matter of trying to censor them or stifle them, but it can be frustrating and it can create problems because when you can't get something cleared, what should be cleared, people may freelance and may go out and say things on an unattributable basis, which, you know, can that makes everybody their own publications review board in their head, and they may actually say things which, you know, would be better left unsaid. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a really hard job, I think, and it's only getting more difficult because, as Bill said, so many former agency officers now are out there speaking and writing in a way they hadn't been in the past. I think it's also challenging because sometimes people writing will look back at what's previously been cleared for release and go off of that. And so sometimes when the PRB doesn't do it exactly the same, people aren't happy. Classification also is, to some extent, subjective. Not all of it. There are certainly definitely classified programs and assets and operations, but analysis, for example, where does my analysis of the current Saudi royal family, what is any of that still in my head influenced by what I did over 10 years ago, 12 years ago? I would say probably not, but right, those. If I were to write something out and submit it, that kind of classification review is a little bit subjective. So it's a hard job for these folks to do this with so much incoming.
Mm-hmm. Bill,
and I'd like to point out too that when I first got to the agency, there weren't as many former people speaking out, and I encouraged the formers that I knew to do so, to write things, to write op-eds, to write books, to appear on TV, because the vast majority, because of the culture there, the vast majority of former agency people who were making it on television and in books and things like that were people who left under some sort of cloud or disgruntled because they hadn't been promoted, they had a bad career or whatever. I mean, we even had people appearing on national TV shows who totally made up the fact that they had ever worked at the agency, and they were treated as if they were experts on things which they were totally making it up. So I encouraged formers to get out there because it would be better to inform the public by people who did not have, you know, a terrible end to their career, who made it past the first level of the GS system, who had experience in the field and in analysis and in senior leadership positions. So I probably contributed to the problem, which now I can't get my own stuff cleared by the PRB because there's so many people ahead of me in the queue. But I think it was all for the good.
And that's different than telling them what to say. You were merely encouraging credible voices, retired officers who could speak on an unclassified basis about what the agency did to do so.
Right. And they would have differing views many times, you know, some of them, you know, because that's the real world. And you know, people who with, you know, their interest was on one particular area and they might disagree with what we were doing, but at least they were well informed as opposed to people just making it up for some reason to score points against an agency that didn't promote them or something like that.
Let's talk about something that's true for many senior positions within the agency, but perhaps for none more than the chief of public affairs and those working in media relations. And that's the job's importance, your latitude in it, even the satisfaction you get from it relying upon your relationship with the director. Now, Marie, in your case, you worked with Mike Hayden, you worked with David Petraeus, and then you worked more extensively with Leon Panetta. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the personality and the style of those leaders affected your job interacting with the media when those people are doing it directly themselves.
Yes, some more than others, I should say. So both General Hayden and Director Panetta, I think for different reasons, but understood the importance of being forward-leaning and proactive with the press. It wasn't a fight with them. It didn't feel like I was pulling teeth when we would say, we want you to do a roundtable with the intelligence reporters. Never felt that way. I think General Hayden's long career at NSA and in the military And then, of course, Leon Panetta, as a former congressman, thought we should do a ribbon cutting for literally everything, which is a good instinct, not practical at the agency.
But it's interesting that you point to them as similar in that way, because yeah. General Hayden's background coming from
very
NSA,
different.
An organization that often did not do media relations at the same level, as opposed to Leon Panetta, who had been working with media for most of the past several decades.
I think, and I don't want to speak for General Hayden, although I've remained in touch with him, I think he recognized that both at NSA and the CIA, the negative press stories coming out of, quote, warrantless wiretapping, the rendition and detention interrogation program, not playing an active role in the press coverage of that probably hurt both agencies. And so there was an incentive, even in times of crisis or controversy, maybe even more so in times of crisis or controversy. Both of them were absolutely committed to this. And then beyond the directors, I should point out there's a whole organization at the agency who goes through past agency documents from historical periods, declassifies them, and releases them. They're not like sexy page one stories, but they're really interesting, and the directors would often participate in those releases. Whole stacks of documents about the Cold War or about, you know, the different times in the agency's history, Vietnam, Air America. This is stuff that historians particularly really valued and I think got us some goodwill with the public that, look, when things were able to be declassified and released, we were actively trying to do that. I think certainly both of those directors felt that way. I'll just say a very brief point about David Petraeus. I only worked for him for several months. I think the transition from military to the agency was more difficult for him for a number of reasons. When you're that level in the military, I think you in some ways have much more ability to sort of freewheel your own press operation, much more than a big bureaucracy like the agency. I think that was a little more of a challenging transition for him. But I cannot say enough good things. One last point, I'm sorry, I will let Bill chime in here then. The transition from a Republican administration to a Democratic one that I lived through and worked through, that is a difficult transition under any circumstance, especially one where the incoming Democratic president ran against many of the policies of the previous administration at the agency. I think Leon Panetta coming in and very quickly showing the workforce that he would have our back publicly and privately, even when it was difficult under this changing set of rules, was very important, because you cannot do good media relations outward facing if you don't have the support of the workforce behind you at the agency. And Panetta learned that and did that really well.
That's on the director's side. Did you get the sense from the reporters you were talking to and others that they were trying to, in a sense, exploit this new administration coming in to get more out of you about those programs?
Probably. I mean, but the thing is, the intelligence reporters, as Bill's alluded to a few times, they actually aren't very political reporters. At least they weren't when I was there. They very much were like intelligence nerds and loved everything about it. And so they were much more interested in the policies. There were political dust ups. I mean, I don't know if people remember Leon Panetta went after Nancy Pelosi when she said the agency had lied to her. He went after fellow Democrats, in other words, which I think showed reporters and the workforce that Leon Panetta was first and foremost the director of the CIA. He was willing to fight publicly and privately for it. And that, I think, was very helpful in making that transition as not as seamless as it could be, but better than maybe it could have been.
Bill, your tenure in the chief of public affairs position was the era of George Tenet. Describe how your interactions with George defined the scope of the job for you and its evolution, especially the shifts that happened after 9/11 when CIA is suddenly at the forefront of a no-kidding war.
Well, I had a great relationship and still do with George Tenet. He's the reason I went there. I hadn't planned to go to work for the government as a civilian after I retired from the military, but I met him and interviewed with him and thought it would be a lot of fun and a great privilege to work with him, and it was. And interestingly, you know, I survived the transition from one party leadership to another. In the case of Tenet, he was appointed by a Democrat and then kept on by a Republican administration. And it was totally seamless as far as we were concerned. And then it was a kinder, gentler period in life, perhaps. And so, you know, we didn't recognize any political difference within how the agency was handled. Tenet, I always worried that people thought that he must have the worst public affairs officer on the planet when they got to meet him, because he's really good at doing media and he's really articulate and engaging, but he didn't do a lot of it. And I figured that people, once they met him, figured that I had to be really dumb not to put him out more, but he didn't enjoy doing it as much. He thought it was better for him to work inside the building and inside the administration. And for the most part, he did. I would have liked to have seen him do a little bit more than that. But he authorized me to do more than perhaps others might have. He gave me the power to get information out of the agency. In my first couple weeks at the agency, they were having their 50th anniversary celebration, and they had identified 50 trailblazers, people who were emblematic of all the good things at the agency. And so I said, hey, we should put some of those stories out. And people said, you must be new here. And I said, no, we should put some of these stories out. And they said, okay, we'll let you put out the one about the guy who started the credit union. And I said, that's not
what you had in mind.
Not exactly what I had in mind. It went back and forth a couple of times. But the story that we were able to put out was Tony Mendez going into Tehran to help American diplomats get out during the hostage crisis. Tony was, hooked him up with media. Later, he wrote a book. There was another book written about it. Then it turned into Argo.
We had Argo, right, when I was there.
Argo, the best movie. An example of how, if you're empowered by the leadership to find a story that you can put out that doesn't do any damage to national security. I mean, the bad guys knew he had been in there. The only people who didn't know were the Americans, right? So if you can do that kind of thing, if you can find things that you can say empowered by the leadership who can tell the rest of the organization, chill out, then it does good things.
And you picked up on something there, which is empowered by the leadership, that this has to be a choice from the top. You do not have the leeway to open up these things, to open up previously classified operations to the public. Marie, did you find the same thing with your directors, that they empowered you to do what you needed to do?
I did, definitely. I think that they, at least the two I worked for most closely, certainly felt that way. I would point to two different events. One, the worst day of my job that I was there, and one probably the best, that I think Director Panetta, from a public relations perspective, understood we needed to talk about publicly. The first was the attack on our officers at COAST, the base in Afghanistan, right around New Year's, and losing that number of agency officers in one day for a very small agency is devastating. The after-action report, when that was completed, which was not rosy by any means, Director Panetta said to us, we need to figure out how to talk about this publicly. These officers who we lost deserve this. This workforce deserves this. Even though we don't, we made mistakes, we're going to own them. And so we brought in a number of reporters, walked through what we could, obviously, that wasn't classified, or were able to get some things declassified. Because when the agency loses people and we can take some responsibility and figure out ways to do better, he very much believed we should do that. The second, I would say, on the positive side, I was the spokesperson during the bin Laden raid and aftermath, which has gotten some controversy for how much the government writ large talked about that in the aftermath. Living through that, it feels a lot like a blur, but I think Director Panetta realized that there are so many success stories the agency will never be able to talk about. So when we can, and when the national interest is so great that there is a reason not to pat ourselves on the back, but to tell people this is why you invest in intelligence and this is why you invest in special operations, we were going to do that as much as possible. And that absolutely started at the top. There was a mandate. We need to be able to tell as much of the story as we can. Again, not to give Leon Panetta credit, to give the analyst who toiled year after year to find him credit. Because so often, and that's not why you join the CIA. You don't join to get credit. But when you can show the American people that the agency does things right every once in a while, more than they think, that's a good thing for the organization.
We've had this conversation as if, with both of you, that it was you sitting in a room with the director working all this out. But usually there were other people in the room. And I'm thinking here of some of the people in the army of lawyers that work for the CIA. Bill, tell me about some of your interactions with the lawyers. When would they weigh in, either with the director on one of these decisions, whether to open up an operation?
When did they not weigh in?
And when did they sit back and you ended up taking the heat on it?
Well, whoever designed the structure of the agency, interestingly, they put the Office of Public Affairs right across the hall from the Office of the General Counsel and right down the hall from the Office of Legislative Affairs, the people who deal with Congress. So you couldn't help but run into those people on a regular basis. So we were frequently talking to each other. The lawyers, they were in some cases, risk averse. We had some really good ones. We had some that understood that in order to get things done, sometimes you need to make some decisions, you need to declassify some things, you need to take some risks. And so we had some particularly good lawyers who understood, and they got their marching orders from the same director that I got mine from. And so that was great. And it working well with the Office of Legislative Affairs types as well. So it was quite a combination of people. We didn't always share the same interests, but it turned out to work pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I didn't find the lawyers as much of a problem, quite frankly, as the senior operations people, because the lawyers, especially the lawyers that were assigned to places like the Counterterrorism Center, who were very involved in some of the operational details, I think were someone we worked with a lot, I should put it that way. It was the operations officers who were often, they hesitated to tell you. I mean, you know, we had very good relationships, particularly at the top. But when they said, you need to talk to this chief of station, and like, that person doesn't know me. And it was the operations officers that were often more like, just say nothing. Just tell them it's not true. Well, is it not true? Well, I'm not going to tell you that. Well, then we have a problem, right? So I actually didn't find the lawyers particularly difficult. I think that the workforce in general is obviously media hesitant. And it really is dependent upon not just the director, but the head of the operational division and the analytic division to set tones for their workforce that if they ask you something, you're going to answer.
Well, there's a real shift from the line work of a GS-11, GS-12, GS-13 analyst or operator or technical officer who never interacts with the media in a general course of a career. And then suddenly, if they get to a certain level of management position, they're expected to handle it just fine. And that's a real shift for almost anyone to handle. Is there some role for, what would you say, media training or some role for educating the workforce about the media other than saying, please don't talk to reporters unless you're authorized?
We could probably send them this podcast.
Yeah.
It's a good start.
That would probably...
I think when people get to the level of Deputy Director of Operations or the Analytic Corps, I'm sorry, I don't know what it's called now. It has a new name since I left. They're generally pretty savvy. And so you meet with them as soon as they get into their position, you start meeting with them and they start to figure out they can trust you. So I think once you get to that level, it's pretty good. But you're right. And that's why I think it's also hard to find people from inside the building who want to do media relations. They just want nothing to deal with the press. And so that, I think, is also a challenge, just a hiring challenge for these jobs.
And also depends on what they've seen ahead of them as they've grown in their career. I worked with two successive deputy directors for operations, one of whom was very good with the media, did a wonderful job, seemed comfortable doing it. And the next, I heard him say once with crossed arms and the scowl on his face, I'm not talking to those damn reporters again. And it was funny.
I can guess who you're referring to.
They were in the exact same position.
Yeah.
And yet they had different reactions based on their experiences.
Well, just look at current CIA Director Gina Haspel, yeah. Right? I mean, at the top of the food chain now, but having had a career where this was not what she did.
Right.
I think she's wonderful in many, many ways. And I think at some point she should do more publicly. I think she'd be a real asset to the agency. Mm-hmm.
You may remember at the agency, at least back when I was there, we had the Lotus Notes. It was an internal email system, and there was a capability to put at the top of your message and you know, little motto or whatever. And mine was, it could be worse. And that's what I would always tell the, you know, because when I would meet with people and I'd say, you know, well, we're going to talk to this reporter, we're going to explain this operation. And they come back and they say, well, that didn't come out badly. You know, that didn't come out the way I wanted. I said, well, it could be worse. And I'd explain to them, if we hadn't engaged, it would have looked worse. We would have looked, you know, terrible. So we damaged controls. I think that's the message to a lot of people there. You need to get to, if you're a perfectionist, if you think every story is going to come out making the agency look wonderful and brilliant and kind and gentle and smart and capable, you're going to be disappointed, you know, on a regular basis. But if you understand that if we can just make it look less bad, if people can understand on a greater percentage of times that we're doing the right thing for the right reason, then it's worth the effort.
A couple of final points. Marie, you had the contrasting experience of working media relations for CIA and then the State Department, two mm-hmm. very different organizational cultures, to put it mildly, with two very different histories of interacting with the press. What was your transition like from the world of the clandestine operations to the world of diplomacy?
Well, it was interesting because I had a year in between when I went and worked on a presidential campaign. So I went from CIA media relations to politics and press, which is night and day, right? And at the agency, it very much was. I did not know what political party most of the people I worked with there.
Right.
You know, I served Democrats and Republicans proudly. And then I went to something that was incredibly partisan. I think that I will give some credit here to the CIA reporter cadre. I think they are, and my State Department friends are going to kill me for saying this, but I think they are able to keep politics and partisanship out of it much more. At least they were when I was there. They much more focused on the substance. It's probably gotten a little worse since I left. But I think that, you know, the benefits of doing a daily press briefing, which I did on camera, is that every day I'm forced to answer questions from reporters, and it's an action forcing mechanism inside the State Department. You are forced every day to say, I'm going to get asked about this. You need an answer, actually, before 2 p.m. when I'm at that podium. So it forces action, but it also is much more of a show. Reporters perform for the cameras. I get judged on my performance because it's on camera. So it's, and they expect more of you because the State Department is, so much of what they do isn't classified. They expect so, so much more.
Yeah. Let's close out with a quick conversation about leaks, unauthorized disclosures versus authorized disclosures, because you've already talked about the role a director plays in saying, yes, we'll open this up. We'll talk about this. Obviously, the idea is that the director can, in a sense, make a disclosure authorized by deciding that this is something that needs to be put out there. Bill, talk a little bit about the mechanics of that in a general sense from your experience. And then on the flip side, the reaction of the director you worked for when there was an unauthorized disclosure and how he felt about those.
Well, if there's something which the director feels is in the national interest to get out, that's something which had been classified under his authorities, because there are some things that are classified by presidential authorities, and then you need a presidential sign-off in order to get it declassified. But assuming it's within his authority and he thinks that a case can be made about why it's in the interest of the country to declassify this, he can authorize to do so. And by a specific, you know, direction to you, he can authorize you to talk about it. Doesn't happen that often where it's a clear cut, you know, I'm doing this because there's some danger, but it does happen. Far more often is the situation where somebody else has handed out classified information to a reporter. They come to you, to the spokesperson, and they ask you about it. And now you're at that position of trying to decide, do I just decline to comment? Do I try to talk them out of doing it? Do I, you know, report this to the lawyers who report it to the Justice Department to file a criminal referral? There are lots of steps that need to be taken. Sometimes, many times, classified information gets out there, but it just doesn't get noticed. It goes off into the ozone. It's in a story, and it goes off, and people don't know whether it's true or it's not true. But other times, it is so damaging that you need to engage to try to keep it out of the media. We didn't do that often in my experience, and we had only mixed success. Sometimes the media would say, I'm sorry, I don't see it that way. It's a risk I'm willing to take. You say somebody might die. Well, I'm willing to take that risk. You know, it might be courageous of them to make that decision. Other times they would say, okay, we get it. Let us know. Usually what they say is, okay, we'll sit on this story now, but if you get a hint that somebody else is going to put it out, then let us know, because if somebody's going to do something irresponsible, we want to do it first. You know, so it, all kinds of different reactions you get, but that's what makes the job particularly difficult.
Marie, what about that mix in your time?
I think I echo everything Bill said. The one other point I would add is I think the trend now among news organizations is to not print sensitive things less and less. In other words, I think they were more willing in the past, if you said this would put someone's life at risk or operation at risk, they were more willing to fudge the details or not print everything because of national security. I think they are less likely to take those considerations seriously today. And I think that's a huge problem for national security. I'm a huge proponent of the First Amendment and a free press. But I think that the willingness of news organizations more and more today to print names of undercover operations officers or details about classified operations, I think is incredibly irresponsible and not germane to reporting the stories they're doing. And I think that's a problem.
We will close on that. Bill, Marie, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Marie Harf and Bill Harlow for coming on the podcast. Please give us a rating and review wherever you found us, and share us with your friends and followers on Twitter, Facebook, any social media. The Lawfare Podcast, as always, is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.